visit the college now, I still keep in contact with some of those same faculty, right?
Yeah.
I'm still involved with Bowdoin. I'm on the, they have an inaugural Black Alumni Board. We're into our third year. I'm on the board. I try to do things to be a support to the community because I did understand, even coming out of Bowdoin with the good and the bad, it was my America, right? And it was very much the America that I've lived and worked in ever since I got out of Bowdoin 35 years ago, right? So fast forward to when I've done DEI training, one of my coworkers asked me one day, how can you listen to the things that people are saying in the training? I'm like, because it's not the first time I'm hearing it. I've rarely heard anything I didn't hear 35 years ago, right? But I'm able to understand motivation and where things are coming from. So if I'm in a teaching and a training setting, I need you to say some of the things you've heard or that you think so that we can kind of tailor it. But I'm not like, I can't believe they said that to me. So it was a lesson in living.
Hearing you tell me that story, like how could that person ask you that as a trainer when we are all trained, right? Our parents train us.
Right.
We must have said something in our lives to our parents at some point, which is like, how can this this person say that to me?
But what you see is that you understand that the dialogue in the households are not the same.
Yeah.
And so then you say, so when you think about a workplace, people say, why do you have to have, hate to say this, diversity, equity, and inclusion? Because people didn't get it at home. That's why you have to have it. Because people are sitting in rooms going to tears because they're saying, oh my God, I've been working with students and I've been saying that forever and I didn't realize that was offensive. Okay, wipe your tears and let's figure out what we're going to do with the curriculum now so it doesn't happen again.
Right.
So that's why I take the space that I take, because I'm all about, again, like I said, know the game, understand the rules and play the game, right? But you can't have that mindset. Back in the day, they used to say, well, people ought to know. People should know. People don't know because they haven't been taught. So when I fast forward to, you know, I work through social services, I'm like, I'm going to go into nonprofit management because I need to, I'm a gap analysis person. I want to help make sure systems are effective that people need to get what they want. I don't want to be in direct services, right?
Now, this is where it gets interesting, though, because your career, even in the conversations that we've had, I think is very just fascinating and also quite noble. But tell us about, let's fast forward a little bit and let's get into your career and the spaces and places that you've been in and some of the challenges, but also some of the rewards. Share with us some of the rewards that you've experienced.
So what I say about career paths to people all the time when I mentor young people is I say plan 5 years in advance, because I guarantee you, you cannot sit at this graduation door with the plan for the next 30 years. Life just doesn't happen that way, right? So my career unfolded to me as I was walking it out through a variety of ways, oftentimes through people in a lot of ways. Like, hey, did you hear about this opportunity? Oh, no, I didn't. Let me follow up. But I started off in social services, and again, did some really critical work in terms of understanding that the community, the people are the center of all of the systems.
And where were you? What agency?
I started off in Children and Family Services.
Okay.
At Jane Edna Hunter.
Okay.
Cuyahoga County.
Okay.
And literally, because I had a...
That's a big start.
It was a crazy start. Because I had planned to relax for about 4 or 5 months. I had an aunt who had a friend who was like, no, you need to apply for this job. And this long story short, I ended up at Children and Family Services. I did 6 years there. I was 22 years old, going out to people's homes, telling them how to take care of their kids, and didn't have a kid in the world. But I learned how the systems interacted and how they didn't interact, right? And I dealt with juvenile court, and I understood how the law began to work, but how also the law was really kind of a perpetrator in sort of dividing families. One of the things I did that it was
so
cool,
there was a duality going on,
real huge, and it's like, wait a minute, what do I want to live for? But I started the case review unit. I was one of the original supervisors of the case review unit. And it, when it started, it's actually been replicated now. Annie Casey Foundation came in and replicated it. But it was just about saying, let's look at the systems that need to work with the families, not just the family as the victim or the family as the perpetrator. Because my perspective was, if you're in juvenile court, if you're in education, even in the health system, you're talking about the same people in specifically in urban communities, if it's low-income people, if it's people of color, and you're trying to get them to navigate systems instead of systems organizing themselves to navigate around the people.
Right, because you're not, the reality is you're not really going to fix the system, at least probably not in a way that is really, truly meaningful.
Well, you got to decide what needs to be fixed, mm-hmm. right? Because poverty is a business. So I learned early on that there are some people felt like if everybody gets well, I won't have a job. If everybody takes care of their children well, I won't have a job. If everybody, you know, so there's that mindset of that. But there's also this whole idea of what is health? And what is health from a cultural perspective, right? So I worked in social services. I'm like, okay, let me get into nonprofits. So then I started working. I worked in a couple organizations after I got my master's at Case. And I worked in Catholic Charities, and I worked in CLGC, and I worked at CMS School District in administration when Barbara Burr Bennett at the time thought we need to have some business people in central office. So I was a part of that kind of project and experiment, looking at compliance and looking at community engagement, which was really just starting at that time. And, you know, schools have to partner with the community, right? No matter what kind of school you are. And educators have to respect the community, and they have to respect the people in the community, and they have to respect the parents in the community, or we just all like. So I was always kind of navigating this sort of strategic development and planning and, you know.
I mean, listening to you, I'm feeling exhausted just listening to you. There's a lot of all these things which seem that you would think are pretty simple and straightforward. Every step and every instance requires like some type of approval or some type of review.
And some acknowledgement that, number one, I don't have the full picture. And there's always this sort of tension between doing what we always have done and doing what needs to be done to be effective. So, like, I'm, like, all about outcomes, and I'm all about, you know, let's be clear on what the agendas are. What are the, you know what they are so we know how to navigate them.
So, in a sense, like, it seems like you're a DEI professional, and you have your PhD, and your background in diversity, equity, inclusion, and all these other things that are related to that. It seems like it's in itself, it is actually what we originally started talking about, which is the issues of gender, race, and all these biases and stuff. The conflicts between new ways of thinking versus the old paradigms, right? And again,
I fell into DEI. So DEI evolved in my world.
Yeah.
I would never say that I was a DEI professional,
okay,
right?
Okay.
I was always, let me be clear. I was always one of the few black women in the room.
Okay.
Either because as I advanced in leadership and responsibility, when I was even at Children's Services going down to Columbus for state meetings, I was often sometimes the only one that physically looked like the people we were talking about. And then people run that tension sometimes with serving with and serving for, and then you got to kind of say, no, I'm not them. I can't speak for that because I never, but I'm trying to help.
Right.
So I would say that I always found myself in spaces where, like, being the one to say we have to think different. And I've had people assume how I thought and presume how I thought, or presume I knew how they thought. But I've always been the one to have to say, we got to think different, right? And how do I get there? Well, what are the outcomes? Are we achieving what we needed to? And then where is community, where customer satisfaction, customer engagement? So I kind of found, like I was telling somebody, I ultimately the last 5 years or so have been prioritizing a lot of DEI as a part of organizational development, right? Because
right.
That's my area. And what does that look like? It varies, right? Is it about customer engagement? Is it about, you know, the funders expecting us to do this and we are way over here and how do we get there? Is it about, you know, what
is it even about DEI?
DEI is always prevalent, right?
Hear me out. I'm saying, like, the stuff that you're talking about, it actually is it's, yeah, diversity, equity, inclusion, but it's also all the other things that competency, literacy,
like
of different areas.
It's
just
like people.
People. Just dealing with
and
people.
And wherever you have people, you have to have
training.
You know, you have to, you
engagement.
Have to, right, because humans are, you know, even in this world of technology, somewhere at a base somewhere is some people, right? And it's some people who know certain things about each other or don't know. There's some people who have assumptions and presumptions or may not have any at all, right? There is the need for people to feel included to do their best, right? Or somebody from Ohio.
Yeah.
Quick back to Bowdoin. People would say to me when I was in my freshman year, where are your overalls? And I did not know what they were talking about. And someone else had to explain to me that people in New England thought everybody in the Midwest was a farmer.
Well, they probably were.
And and I'm like, but in the Northeast Ohio tip, in a little bit in 30 miles, we not farmers,
right?
But I did not have a clue what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, that's what you, you know, like people who think Lake Erie is a lake you can sit on one side and look across. Not a Great Lakes, guys. It's like a huge thing. But people have, people make assumptions and presumptions, specifically when they don't know, right? But then there's also that intentional, I know, but I want to be better than you, and that's a whole nother issue, or I need to put you down so I can feel up, which are a whole human interaction issues, right? But really, realistically, so when people are like screaming about DEI, I'm like, as long as you have more than one person in the room, you have diversity automatically. Right now, if we are, if you make decisions that I guarantee you, almost any decision that you make for other people, somebody is not gonna, apply, right? So equity is like out the window, and then inclusion. If I'm here and you don't even acknowledge that the possibility that I could have some difference or different ways of thinking or different ways of doing, we already have like created spaces that force me to not feel emotionally, psychologically, or physically safe. And really, if the world wanted to really look at it, when I'm talking about DEI, I'm talking about creating spaces where people can feel included. And by included, I mean those three areas. Because I have been in spaces, professional spaces. I have been going to a gas station and suddenly feeling psychologically unsafe because of the t-shirts that people are wearing in the room, right? Different things happened to me, or I got my PhD. I was working in a foundation as a program officer. I got my PhD, and can I tell you the number of times that people would go to my white coworker and say, hello, Dr. Hatton. Instead of what I consider common courtesy, walking in to meet new people and say, hi, who, my name is so-and-so,
and
what's your name?
And I'm here to meet Dr. Hatton.
But because they couldn't conceive that a black female would have a PhD, and they knew there was a doctor on the team, they presumed it had to be
that person.
And then it's like, most of the time I didn't have to say a word because any of my, any customers or constituents around would be real clear to say, no, 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 right? Same thing happened, I'm teach a professor at Cleveland State. Students come in, I'm at the front of the room. And so I'm sitting there saying, where's the professor? So, I mean, I have been in spaces and places where it shouldn't, but because this is America, it matters, right? So I've lived DEI, I guess, since Shaw, because Shaw prepared me to be a strong black woman, and, you know, that we knew our history and we knew our culture, and I'm thinking I'm taking this out to the rest of the world.
Yes.
So when I look at...
Good old EC.
I'm telling you, I do nothing but support. It is not the community it was for a variety of reasons. They have a lot to do with unjust systems. However, I still support the Alumni Association and support scholarships. But I can tell you that I tell people all the time, you know, I had a professor in my dissertation who was actually my chair, and I was doing my first defense. And I actually did my dissertation on East Cleveland. They wouldn't let me say East Cleveland. I had to say a small Midwestern all-black community, blah, blah, and it wasn't but one. But anyway, I had a professor, my chair, ask me a question. Well, how can you talk about academic success in East Cleveland? I thought there wasn't any. And I am like, talk about how to do a quick recovery in the middle of a defense from my chair. And I said, well, that would mean that I wouldn't be actually standing in front of you then, right? That was my response. What do you mean? There is no academic success. But again, this man, he wasn't a black man, but I'm thinking you're in the you know what I'm saying.
Right.
So, but in many, many, so again, Bolden prepared me for how to respond. But the fact that we still have to be prepared to respond is why we are where we are today, right? Laws don't change the way people think, right? And we, I kind of was talking about this to somebody, like my generation, I was born 6 months after Martin Luther King was killed. And my generation kind of coming through, we were sort of like the results of the dream of civil rights, right? So people presume that things were better for us because we came after Martin Luther King.
Or would be getting better.
Would be getting better.
Yeah.
And so what I found is sometimes we didn't have the support from black people in higher positions because sometimes they saw us as their competition. And the mentoring was difficult. It was hard to find mentors, which is why I try to do mentoring now. Because it was hard for me to find mentoring coming up through like the first 25 years of my career. One, because oftentimes I was in a position that other black people were not in the organization.
A pioneer.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Too much. And two, because sometimes people didn't want to look like they were favoring me if they were in a higher position, which was a challenge, right? We still see that now. How come LeBron James is helping his son? Why wouldn't he?
Competition.
Help his son?
And it's a dynamic thing.
And legacy.
Yeah.
Which is the other word we don't talk about when we talk about DEI.
Oh.
Legacy is what we use in colleges.
Yeah.
Legacy. Bolden has a list of the guys whose grandfathers and uncles, women don't have that long legacy. But again, see, if you're going to talk about DEI words, you better throw legacy in there to cross that off, but
right.
They don't cross that one. Yeah. So again, so for me, I lived that sort of DEI life before I put those initials into what I do. Because to me, what the doing is what I've done all along. It's like from an organizational effectiveness perspective, how do we make sure an organization can be effective? The people in it feel like they can be productive and therefore they contribute to the effectiveness. That's OD to me, right? Now, the customers, there are some aspects that we have to address. We have to address some aspects of the people we have to collaborate with to get things done outside of our entity. But it starts, to me, the core is really what's so important. And so you cannot have a racist, a sexist environment where, you know, where you have to, neurodiversity, right, is not, there's no room for it. There's no room for physical disability. And then say that we have this, like, nirvana. No, you don't. Like, people learn how to play the game, perhaps, but you're still not getting their optimum productivity or performance, right?
I also think it's, like, something that you shouldn't look at as a, like, a handout or a service. Like, mm-hmm. You are part of this process.
What?
You have to be engaged and also involved.
Agreed.
In this process. You also potentially, and maybe to some degree, one of those people who need DEI training.
Yeah.
Because you can be guilty of saying things offensive
or microaggressions.
Yeah, yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, everybody commits microaggressions because we all have perspective. And typically our perspective is from people we're around or situations we've been in. I tell people all the time, this one used to catch me up. You know, I grew up with parents who had perceptions about your friends, right? So then here I am now with all these young people who are coming through me, through my sister or me. And I would find myself sometime looking at, you know, one of my kids' friends like, why is she friends with that girl with that short dress? And then my kids would say, now, Auntie, why would you say that? I thought you teach DEI. And I'm like, you are right. Let me reframe my thinking. Now, I'm going to watch her and see how she acts, and then we'll see. But I'm like, you are exactly right.
Yeah.
I cannot have a bias
yeah.
because of a hoodie or a skirt or a black nail polish. I cannot.
Or at least have the training or ability to catch
myself.
Yeah.
Right, because
yeah.
we constantly got to pull our own coattails
yeah.
and our
yeah.
peers' coattails and realize, because it's not
put that
hard.
Rubber band on your wrist.
It's not
yeah.
hard to slip
yeah.
into biases or judgments that your grandmother said 30 years ago. It's not hard. It's not hard to slip into biases or judgments, even when you know that's not really how you feel. But I could have just watched something last night, and I'm like, oh, darn. So to me, I kind of say that this, which is why it's ludicrous to me in society now, that people are trying to get rid of DEI. I'm like, do you know what you're getting rid of?
Yeah.
And I don't think people, you're saying, when you say, forget make America great again, I'm like, so what do you mean? We should have black only and white only.
Well, some people might think of that as like, we've come this far, and they might view it as, there really isn't any more maybe that can be done other than just merging everyone together. It's going to be a bit messy, but let it just work itself out. What do you say to that?
If it would have worked itself out, we would have never needed civil rights, right? If it would have, because human nature doesn't change unless forced. So it tends to seek out opportunities to be on top.
Yeah.
And in order to be on top, it means it has to push that deficit-based mindset. That non-strength-based approach, that piece of the pie, if I got some, you can't have some. That's like the human nature mindset without knowledge, experience, or training.